The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Jason Freeman. I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Marcus Anthony Hunter. The Scott Wall Endowed Chair in the Social Sciences Division, Professor of Sociology and African American Studies at UCLA, Dr. Marcus Anthony Hunter coined the term Black Lives Matter. His books include Black City Makers, How the Philadelphia Negro Changed Urban America, The New Black Sociologists, and Chocolate Cities, The Black Map of American Life, co-authored by Zandria F. Robinson. He formerly served as the inaugural chair of UCLA's African American Studies Department and president of the Association of Black Sociologists. His research has been supported by the National Science Foundation and Social Science Research Council, and he has appeared across a wide array of print and broadcast media. Dr. Hunter joins us tonight with his latest book, Radical Reparations, Healing the Soul of a Nation. In it, he ventures beyond the contentious current debate about the country's responsibility for atoning for its earlier sins to lay out an ambitious but practical 7-point compensation plan for Black Americans. Tonight's author will be joined in conversation by Tamala Edwards. She is the anchor for 6ABC's Action News Morning Edition, and perhaps even more importantly, she is a great friend to the Free Library and us here in the Author Events program. So everyone, please join me in welcoming tonight's guests.
Good evening. Thank you for being here tonight. Marcus, thank you for this book.
Thank you for reading it. I enjoyed it so.
They had to kick us out back there. We were having a great time just talking. And I told you I was gonna start with a W.B. Du Bois question because he's a touchstone for you.
Yes.
And he's famous for his Philadelphia Negro book, yes, and telling complicated truths.
Yes.
And that was something that you got at in a complicated subject in a different way. Why was he important to you, and why was that sort of the keyhole for you?
Yeah, if not for W.E.B. Du Bois, I wouldn't have a PhD. When I went to graduate school at Northwestern, I didn't really know what I wanted to study. Like a lot of people, I said something like, so I was a high school teacher at Orton Reed for 2 years before I went to graduate school. And so I think I said I wanted to study like Black kids in school. Mm-hmm. And when I got to Northwestern, I'm like, I'm not going to do that. So I don't know what I'm going to study. And while I was there, a lot of sociology has been generated by studying Chicago. And so when I started living there and I started reading and learning all of this stuff, I kept thinking, like, Chicago is extremely different from Philly, New York, Atlanta, D.C., everywhere, but everybody keeps using this place as an example. And I thought, like, but the first book of American sociology about Black people is Du Bois's, and it's about Philly. So what if I just ask myself, like, I'm gonna do a project about what happened to the Seventh Ward after Du Bois wrote about it? And that became my dissertation and became my first book. And in fact, I spent an entire year on a National Science Foundation grant in a room not far from this room on microfilm every single day. I used to come for 2 weeks a month and stay with my mom and sister, and I would read newspaper clippings, and I would read deeds and leases, and I had quarters because you had to like do the microfilm just right so you can get 2 pages for one, you know, all that kind of stuff. And what he says in that work still applied for everything that I saw. So for example, at the end of the Philadelphia Negro, he says, what is happening to Black people in Philadelphia is just a product of centuries of dispossession and discrimination and prejudice. In fact, poverty and crime are just symptoms of racism. And nobody listens to him. So when I get to my research, I find that there's a tenement collapse that happens that kills a black woman and her children in 1935, right before Christmas. And that led to the creation of public housing in Philly and also then nationally. And everything that he described about the living conditions then, and mind you, he studied that neighborhood from 1603 until 1897. He said there were windowless rooms, no sanitary equipment, bad ceilings. The roof fell in on these people 30 years later. And so it was like, he said this already. And he said it about this exact population. Can you imagine the first PhD black person from Harvard says this is the condition, and then nobody listens to him. And then people literally die because of it. And so he's been with me since then. You know, like, I thought every time I would start a new project, I would be able to say, you know, Dr. Du Bois, thank you so much for your help. It's been real. And then he just pop up again, you know, it'd be like, he's not done with me yet, you know, kind of thing. So he's really important because he also was a poet. He also was a novelist. He also was an activist. And so as I've, you know, progressed into my own life, there are so many of those features that I am to myself. And so he just becomes a constant source of inspiration of like, this guy did it, you know, so I know that it's possible. And he also gives you license and invitation to be creative with social science. So, you know, people love The Souls of Black Folk, but it's written by a sociologist. And so it was like, how can I marshal all of that and put it into a topic like reparations?
And we'll come back to him talking about intellectual reparations, because you get to him in your closing essay. I was telling you the book is surprising because when I got it and I saw radical reparations, I was like, whoo, we're going to have a lot of graphs and charts and numbers and dusty facts. Let me get a glass of water. And I opened it and I was like, what is this? I don't know if I like it. And then I was like, I love it. And you go back to something that is the most seminal part of childhood to get at this topic, which is something I haven't seen before. And that's just a simple phrase. Tell me a story. And what made you, you could have gone the sociologist, let me marshal all the evidence. Why did you decide three somewhat interlocking stories instead was the way to do it?
Yeah, it was shout out to, by show of hands, how many people have ever heard of this sociologist? Her name is Lauryn Hill. Yeah. The song is called Everything is Everything. Now, hear this mixture with hip-hop meets scripture, develop a negative into a positive picture. Everything is everything. So it was like, read this mixture where sociology meets scripture, develop a negative into positive pictures. Because the idea is that reparations is a negative conversation. It's one about something that hasn't happened, something that people believe will never happen. Then the people who do believe it don't all believe it the same way. I've been to reparations meetings in California where literally people fight each other, like physical fights, police are called, guns are being called out. Like, so it's a very negative space. And I thought, you know, this negativity is also about the steady diet of negative information we receive as black people, that we receive as Americans, as, that we receive as citizens, as voters, as people, as young people, as old people, that make us see what we don't have in one another. You have this because I don't have, or I have and you don't have. And so I thought, like, well, how am I going to, you know, thread a needle that isn't going to be negative? And I thought the best way to do that is in stories, you know. The shortest distance I learned from an indigenous scholar activist named Liz Medicine Crow. She says the shortest distance between two people is a story. And so I thought to myself, and mind you, I did this before I heard that. So it was like, I heard that later. I'm like, that was right. That's what I felt, where I needed to create worlds that people are not familiar with and everyone has equal footing. So just because you're black, you don't jump into the stories feeling like you have a one-up on somebody or you know something, because nobody knows what these stories are going to be about. They don't really exist. And then if the story has elements in it where you see certain types of repair, so the first parable, you see some form of spatial reparations. What if 40 acres and a mule really did happen? So rather than living in a reality, which we do, where it hasn't happened, what if there's a reality where it has happened? And then you get to see it play out, because right now in a reparations conversation, a lot of conversation is about giving black people land. Where's my land? My grandfather had this land. We need land. We need land. So it was like, let's create a reality where that's happened. That's not what they're asking for. So we can kind of figure out how America works, because underneath all of these requests about reparations, I feel, is sometimes a blind spot about, but America has a way of working. and America has a history of how it created itself. So the question for me is always like, the land thing sounds real good on paper, but because it's America, there's something about me that feels like something in the milk ain't clean. Like, if they gave all these black people all of this land in America, would that really work out well for them? And so that was a tension I wanted to really visit with. And I wanted people to see a world where forms of repair are happening, so you can see what it looks like, but also see some limitations around what could happen if you get some things. You know, what if you did get a check? What if you did get that? And it's also because I'm an optimist, and it's, I believe that all of my storytelling is always generated around the fact that I know for a fact that all of us here, you and I sitting here, survived the unsurvivable. We watch people die, literally. And we're always wondering, what's my purpose in life? Why am I here? I felt very clear about why I was here watching people die and then having actual people die in my life. It's like, oh, I was chosen. And if I was chosen, it means you were chosen, you were chosen, you were chosen, you were chosen, you were chosen. But chosen to do what? With whom? How? And I wanted to contribute opportunity to think about world building together. What is the world we want to live in? We survived the old world together. What is that new world? How can we all get together and build that together? And so that's where the story choice came from, was to create an invitation that meant that you don't need a PhD, you don't need a high school degree, you don't need any of that. You just need imagination and eyes. And if openness. You give me those, right, and an open heart, you know, and if you give me those things, I promise you, you will have an experience. I promise you.
And this is true. And let's talk about the three stories. And what I loved is when you put each one down, you're not done. You know, it's time to do the laundry and think about it. It's time to walk the dog and think about it. It's a couple days later, it's time to think about it. In the first one, I thought you got at the depth of the damage. We're so focused, especially as African Americans, mm-hmm. on ourselves and what has happened. And then by the end, you realize you're not walking wounded alone, mm-hmm. and that this is a lot deeper. Well, what about the indigenous people when they show up and say, right. well, really, that should be mine.
Right.
And I talk a little bit about that, this idea that it's so easy for us to just see ourselves and not realize that this way of being has spoiled it for so many people mm-hmm. on so many levels.
What you said. Oh, man. Thank you so much. Yeah. No one got to read this book before I put it out. And so I'm really having real time interaction of like, oh, wow, like, thank you. The first parable is called the Parable of Jubilee, South Carolina. And it's built on a premise which borrows from part of Souls of Black Folk by Dr. Du Bois, where he talks about a group of Georgians who settled land using General Sherman's Special Order Number 15, which is where the famous 40 acres and a mule comes from. And it was taken away as soon as Reconstruction starts. And so I thought, what if that didn't happen? What if it's 100 years later and it's 1965 and the place Jubilee has become a third the size of South Carolina and the 1965 Voting Rights Act is on the desk of Lyndon B. Johnson and some stipulation about Jubilee is in it? You know, what if that is it? Because it's also almost like black fantasy, you know, like what if we could fantasize about a place that's ours? And I am so black that I know for a fact we would call it something like Jubilee. Okay, like party time, you know, it's the way that you could say party without it sounding like lit or something, you know, Jubilee. And then there's a church that is the kind of center place. And I just borrowed from, you know, I spent a lot of time in a Baptist church as a kid. One of my dear friends, Shanae, her mom, Vivian, would take me to Vacation Bible School, me and my brother Maurice. And I always thought like, when did Bible school become vacation? Like summer vacation Bible school.
When your parents want to pay to teach exactly. you anywhere else exactly. and you could go exactly. there for free and make matchstick crosses. That's
exactly.
when
exactly.
it became
we
a vacation.
We were at Vacation Bible School. And there, you know, you learn a lot of different passages. And the time we were there, it was all about Philippians. I can do all things through Christ that strengthens me. So I knew I was going to use that in this book. But I also knew that I had to call it something that would resonate. And it was like, it became Mustard Seed Baptist Church. Like, I was like, that sounds like a place that would be in Jubilee, South Carolina. And you're going to get there and it's popping. You know, like, you meet this beautiful black girl named Ruby, who is a fraternal twin with her brother Reggie, who can sing. And she's going across the country and showing maps of this magical place that even black people don't know about. And you see her journey going along the way. And in it, I also incorporate one of my spiritual mentors is Professor Derek Bell, who I never got to meet, but he has a book called Faces at the Bottom of the Well, The Permanence of Racism, and he uses parables. And one of his kind of interlocutors is this imaginary lawyer named Geneva Crenshaw. And in his book, Geneva sounds like a radical because she's like, well, you want to fight against racism. What if we made racist laws? And in his book, everything that I say about her is quoted directly from his book. So this is what she says to him in his work. And she says, we should have a racial preferencing law where you can state your preference and say, I don't want black people here. You post it outside and all this other stuff. Maybe we should do that as opposed to this other stuff we do where we try to make everybody get along. And I thought Geneva should be the lawyer for Jubilee. She would be the right lawyer because they would want something like that because they're in South Carolina. They know that's not going to integrate no time soon, you know? So it was pulling all of those different pieces together and to wrap you up in a world that is so black. You know, it winds up culminating in the Jubilee. They have an annual Jubilee in Jubilee Festival. And you have all these performances, and they've been around for 100 years now. So it's a big festival. They're up for legislation. And Motown is popping. So Motown's coming through. James Brown is coming through. Because to me, it's South Carolina. James Brown definitely going to be there. And they're celebrating something. But in that celebration, which is very black, you know, sometimes some of the worst things have happened to us as people in the moments of our celebrations. Just when you think you're free. Just when you get to walk off the plantation, here comes something else. And I wanted to do that, but not be like heavy-handed, to have like a little bit of mystery in it, you know, kind of get you going and also play with pacing a little bit. So this story, I feel, is supposed to move faster, you know, like, because one of the other things is that a technique that I wanted to use in the writing is that I know reparations is not something people read about a lot. There are not a lot of books about it, though they're increasing. Shout out to all of the writers who are doing that. But also, maybe I might be the only choice that somebody makes with reading a reparations book. So I knew I wanted you to get 100 pages in before you realize you don't know if you want to keep continue. And then once you're 100 pages into something, it's like, quitter. You quitter. You know, like, so that's why it's written like that, too. So, like, you're in this last 2 weeks leading up to this 100-year marker that they're on, and all of this time, you're never even thinking about, you know, other claims that people could have, because you're so into, like, is this going to happen for them? Oh, my gosh, they might get it. What if this was real? This sounds amazing. And then there's a blind spot that's revealed right at the very end when she's leaving, effectively, on a midnight train to Georgia. So that was intentional as well, yeah.
And I also love the way that story got at freedom is also within, and all right. of those people looking to be free are busy holding each other down and not letting them be
Big
free.
Time.
Then when you get to the second story, I took it as hurt people hurt people.
Definitely.
And that is a key factor in reparations, that even as you're getting yours, you have to ask, am I hurting others?
Right. Yeah, that's right. So the second parable is called the Parable of New Jerusalem, Uganda. I had learned that in 1903, the Zionist Congress had unanimously endorsed a plan to put Jerusalem, Israel, and Uganda. A man named Theodore Herzl was the person who proposed it, and it never came to pass, you know. So again, like it was like a 40 acres and a mule idea. Like, it just didn't happen. What if it did, you know? And I didn't, of course, no one can write what was going to happen. You know, like, I didn't anticipate a war in Palestine and Israel, but I am glad that I wrote what I did because I think it's another vantage point into the conversation around land as repair. You know, when we think about the world now, we are so connected with each other that it's really impossible to say that nobody ever had this land before you. So when we start thinking about land as repairing people, whose land is it? You know, and I wanted to take that a step further. So you begin it in the first parable, but the second one is squarely a land story. Like, you have a Jewish settlement in Africa, and you basically meet a young woman who's on a flight back from Israel, and she discovers, well, she takes the flight back by herself because she's upset with her people about like a family matter or whatever. And when she gets back, she starts to recognize that she's the only one still there. This story takes place in 1979, 75 years into the history of the settlement, but a year after the Camp David Accords became viable. So the Camp David Accords were with Jimmy Carter, a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel that made Egypt the first, quote, Middle Eastern country, even though Egypt is in Africa, Middle Eastern country that acknowledged Israel as a state. So that happens in 1978. So the idea is a year later, a lot of these people in this settlement maybe no longer want to be in Uganda. They want to be in Israel, in Israel. And so you wind up seeing this interesting story that happens over the last 24 hours of Idi Amin's presidency, because the other part of Uganda is that Idi Amin was really supportive of Zionism until around 1978, when he started to, as they say, hang out with Gaddafi. He became very antagonistic to the kind of idea of a Jewish state. So I wanted to pull that all together. And so the first story is 8 days that happened over 2 weeks. The second is 24 hours. 8 times 3 is 24. So you get the gist of me using the number 8, which astrologically means death, sex, and transformation. So I wanted to be intentional about using that number and playing around with it in time, because also one thing that we do know is a proxy for money is time. Time is money. And we are always told that it's not time for reparations or it won't happen in our time. But here's 2 weeks. A lot can happen in 2 weeks. Here's 24 hours. A lot can happen in 24 hours. Shout out to Kiefer Sutherland. You know, like a lot can happen in 24 hours. And I wanted to have a 24-hour story where you see the native Ugandans receiving back something that was taken from them at the same time that those who have left it in a state of chaos. And now people in this 24 hours are going from, wow, this is all mine, to being terrorized. And what does that mean for what we think land reparations are about?
My favorite of the three stories is the third, which is set in South Africa in multiple places. And it ties to the point you make in the final essay of the damage of racism and dehumanization. We see a family that is sold. Even though slavery is supposed to be over, they're captured by Arab slavers who send them into sex trafficking in India, back to South Africa. They somehow survive, only to watch it all decimated by apartheid. And in the end, the fifth generation of the family says, everybody wants to hear our truth and reconciliation. They want to see our scars, but not heal them. Mm-hmm. And that made me think of all the parts of history we know. Mm-hmm. We know Tulsa. We know the Red Summer of 1919. Mm-hmm. We know the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We know Breonna. Mm-hmm. We know Trayvon. Mm-hmm. We know George. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to see our scars, but no one wants to heal them.
Mm-hmm. Tamla, you better. What she said. The third story, the parable of the People's Republic of South Africa, is a culmination of several years of traveling in and through Africa and trying to do my very best to heed the warnings, the caution, and the encouragement I receive from our African brothers and sisters to not forget about them, you know, to remember them and to include them. And when I went to the slave castle, Elmina, which is the largest one of all of them in Ghana, we went on our tour, and you see the slave dungeons, women's dungeon, the men's dungeon. And then curiously, there are at least like four different churches inside this inside the slave castle. One is Portuguese, one is Dutch, one is British, one is French, because every slave driver who came and bought the castle would put like a church there so they could go repent, you know, as they're doing these horrible things around them. So there's like six churches inside of a slave castle. And we get upstairs to the top one, and there are probably maybe, I want to say, about eight other people, African-Americans in particular, in this top chapel. And when I get up there, they are bawling, crying. They're devastated. And many of the tour groups, they're devastated. And I can't tell you exactly why I felt differently. I could just tell you that I immediately went into the Caravan spinoff, victory is mine, victory today is mine. Because like it's called the door of no return. Like, I'm not supposed to be here at all. And I'm really here. and I'm a whole black ass professor. I paid for my ticket. They gave me a tour. Like, joy is mine today. You know, it's like, I'm telling Satan, you know, something right now in this space. So before I knew it, the people who were balling, we all started singing this song, you know, like, and I just thought, like, that was so powerful. And we all got back here, and we should remember that. They tell us to be mad at Africans because they sold us, and that's true on some level. They tell us to be not go back to Africa because Africa's not built up. Maybe that might be true or not. But ultimately, they still think about us. They still hold true that we existed, even if it's a slave dungeon. Like, we were people. We were a part of them. And I got to come back. And so I say all that to say, when we get back downstairs, the tour guy says, you know, this was one of the better tours I've ever given. You know, like, you guys are different. You know, I'm like, oh, I just got caught with the spirit or whatever. And so he says, well, if you think this is bad, there are slave castles that don't exist for a slavery that continues. And we're like, what? Really? What? He said, the Arab slave trade has trafficked 10 times as many black Africans, and it continues today. Hmm. Nobody talks about it. There's no slave castle for it. And I said, I'm going to write about that, because I, as a person who went to school for 25 years to become a professor, had no knowledge. Until that black Ghanaian man said that to me in that room, I had never thought about that. I had never been educated about slavery as a continuous spectrum of black people being held as property by all people. Like, I never really connected that. And so for the parable, the last one, the goal was to begin the story at the end when Britain no longer practices slavery. So it's 1827 when it starts. And you find yourself on the Oba River in Nigeria, where there are fishermen who are finishing their day. And two rival fishermen have two sons, and so they're like rivals. And as the story unfolds, the rivalry kind of dissipates because there's a siege that finds them on their boats as they're finishing. And their fathers and the sons are captured, or at least three of them are. And then it turns into this thing where they go across the desert and all of these other things that start to happen to them. And part of the Arab slave trade, which still continues today, is people being castrated, for example. People dying in the desert. You know, there are many stories of people's bones being in the desert. And so I wanted to bring all of that to life and see these little boys who are about 12 years old when this is all happening go through this experience and try to each time trying to get free each time, and then seeing them add on Wolof people, add on Igbo people along. And so the way that we kind of think about slavery is we think West Africa as two or three or four countries and not a 17 tribes of people. You know, so Bantu people were brought into slavery. You know, we just think Bantu people are in South Africa. They're everywhere in Africa. Zulu people were brought into slavery. So it was trying to also help us understand the eclectic nature of our own genealogy of all of those people. And when we would all be together, we were with people we never saw before, from countries we never saw before. We're from Africa, but they never saw the desert before. They didn't know what that was. So seeing them travel through that and then be brought around and then into South Africa and then experience some form of freedom, because South Africa ends slavery in about 1843. So when they get there, they get to have a fishing business, they start opening things, they have all of this stuff going on, and then apartheid is made into law in the late 40s. And so what starts to happen is it starts to get taken away, so you get the generation that survives slavery, and then you get the generation that now has to survive apartheid. And then you get the generation that survived apartheid and is telling America how it what they did was only the tip of the iceberg. There's more that can be done. And if South Africa can do it, why has America never even tried? You know, that's the whole idea, to make a global point. And one thing that she says in her speech, so my final character, Fatu, she receives her name as an overlap from a woman who tried to escape when the young boys were captured. So one of the principles of the story is that those men keep those names alive. along the way. And so she bears the name of a lot of the people who were in it. And so she's telling who she is, and she's saying, I'm Fatu, and she goes through her name and everything. And she starts to use different things like the sun and the moon, because we always hear reparations is unbelievable, it's impossible. And so she starts off her speech before the UN is where she is in the setting, where she says, if I told you about a star that could heat the whole world up, you know, and if there weren't clouds, you could burn to the ground, you would say that's unbelievable. But then I say, there's the sun, that's what it does. If I told you that there was this planetary object, another star that was created from a bunch of dead matter that controls the ocean and emotions, and said to me, that's not believable, nothing does that, there's the moon. So if these two things that are unbelievable are possible, why is reparations so difficult? So it's a way to really talk about how nature reinforces the impossibility of what's possible. Like, maybe we're making it impossible. Maybe our minds are fixed. And my hope is that all three stories give a sort of like combat the steady diet of misinformation, of distraction, of hopelessness, of zero sum with something that's much more positive and possible.
You know, you say something that I think it was your grandmother said to you, little things add up to big things. And you say it's not just one kind of reparations. You say it's political, intellectual, legal, economic, social, spatial, and spiritual. But we just talk about it like it's money, and right. That's the least of it.
Right.
And there was one thing that I wanted to read. Even when coming from an innocent perspective, these questions treat money as a one-dimensional rather than a multifaceted object that it is. Time is money, currency is money, wealth is money, access is money, energy is money, memory is money, history is money, repair is money, recovery is money, respect is money, dignity is money, truth is money, healing is money, restoration is money, power is money. It's not about the money.
Right.
So explain to us what it's about.
Yeah, it's about understanding that something like slavery is a breaking of the most sacred covenant that we share with each other. We are the last of the Homo sapiens. In fact, I like to encourage people after today, for the next 7 days, only refer to yourself and others as Homo sapiens. See how much you can do that. And you ask yourself, why do we have all of these other proxy words? Human, people, person. And I think part of why you get away with doing some of these things is because you don't call the person what they are. You say property, this, that. If you have to keep calling them a Homo sapien, would we be in the reality that we're in? And so really getting to the root of words and why we have them, and to understand that when we violate each other, we're violating the thing that we share, which is a covenant of humanity. And too many people focus or hear when Black people talk about slavery as like Black people just listing all of their upset, or Black people calling white people out, or Black people, you know, marching with torches. But instead, what they should hear is, we violated a sacred covenant. There is no check that can repair your smile. There's no check that can do that. There's no check that can give you back what was taken. So we have to start thinking much more creatively about how we can think about that repair. And I think rather than it being a source of pain, I see reparations as a creative opportunity that we can actually create a bunch of things that we want to experience and see, rather than thinking about who's getting a check and who isn't. And by the way, checks should be cut. That's not a problem. And for people who, and I'm glad you read that passage, when I'm in a lot of legislative space, people will say, well, Black people, they're not financially literate. Black people, you know, they just go and spend it on Gucci. Meanwhile, Gucci like, yeah, like, please, new bags, you know, like, they can't wait. You know, Lenox Mall is waiting for reparations. So all that to say, but it focuses on the wrong thing. When you're hit by a car and you receive a settlement, it doesn't matter what you do with that money. And nobody thinks your leg is going to be the same as it was before that car hit you. You're never going to be the same. If you want to go make it rain in Magic City after that, that's your business. And in fact, Black people are the most likely of any demographic to recycle their money back into the economy. Black people spend it, as I was told by my dad, you spend it before you get it. So what I hear when I hear that statement then is a fear that's being fed, because we know for better or for worse, maybe Black people don't have the financial literacy that they would have, which is why I'm writing what I'm writing, because I would like to see an infrastructure of support for Black people who might get scammed, who might get taken, led astray, run amok, bamboozled, versus talking about what we might do with money that we might get. What is the infrastructure of safety and security that needs to happen versus focusing on people's pathologies and dysfunctions? Because the money is going to leave their hands. This we know for sure. Another question, which is why I say currency is money, is that I have a concern that the minute that some kind of reparations go to a community of African-American or Black people is the minute that they then say the dollar is worth half as much as what it's worth. They can do that at the Fed overnight. The minute that they say, oh, you have $1 million in the bank is the minute that now you no longer need 5%, 10%, or 20% for a house. Now you need 100% for your house. Now the interest rate is 10%. That's what I'm worried about. Another thing that the first parable plays out is that in Jubilee, why they get a lawyer named Geneva Crenshaw is because when this land starts popping, then there are white people who try to be blockers. They're like, you know what? I did my own genealogy and my great-great-grandfather was a slave. Where are my 40 acres? I should be at Jubilee. And they start going to court. So they're like, we need to find a lawyer to help us deal with these lawsuits. Because now white people are making claims. And I think that's another thing that because we don't talk about reparations enough, we don't talk about the other side of it at all, which means people are always worried about who's eligible on the Black side. I'm sure people will be going to me, you, and DNA or whatever that stuff is called and locating their Aunt Jemima, their this person, that person, Uncle Ben was my great-great-grandfather. Where's my check? And we don't think about that because all we're fed is a story about Black people getting something. And when Black people are getting something, we're allowed to dismiss it, diminish it, fabricate it, lie about it, not give it partially, talk about it badly. But in fact, when them PPP loans came out, that was a demographic that everybody, we heard Congress people got PPP loans. So for me, I think if there is reparations, we need to have a conversation about who else is going to be getting it. How else are they accessing it? Which means we need a lot of forms of it in the first place, because we have to repair the spiritual harm. You have to repair the social contract that was damaged. You have to repair the legal system that was meant to uphold slaveholders' rights, not to abolish it. So the 13th Amendment exists, and a whole bunch of civil rights acts exist, but we live in a reality that shows that amendments and legislation alone are not a large enough combatant against the vestiges of slavery. It's too much of the system that was built on preserving that right for people, the right to own people. And so my Fatu character in the last thing in the UN, she says, and you know, everybody likes to use this new age term called human trafficking. That's slavery. That's the other problem about the words that we use, because we don't call it slavery. We're allowed to think that it ended. So when we're hearing about Centoya Brown, she's not a slave. She's a human trafficked person. No, it's just because slavery never ended. It just, you stop being able to use it. Like I like to say with Voldemort in Harry Potter, you know, just don't say his name. No.
I'm going to ask one last question that is going to be the opportunity for others here to talk about it. You've been working on legislative efforts to try to push something forward, looking at the dysfunction in Washington.
Yes, oh my gosh.
I know. Keep up the fight, but I don't know. And talking about your overall sentiments in the last essay, you say something that I thought was interesting. There's victory in surviving. There's sadness in thriving.
Yeah.
What did you mean with that?
Yeah, when I became a professor at Yale, I was really sad. And I could not explain it. Like, because I remember my dad said, you know, Yale is number two, so you were the number two draft pick. Okay? That's what you need to be saying to yourself. Every time you go there, like, I was number two in a draft. I'm like, oh, you know, that football metaphor is interesting. You know, it kind of applies. But the school itself, the school that I was across the street from was the John C. Calhoun School. John C. Calhoun was a senator who owned slaves, endorsed slaves, and also fought against the Union abolishing slavery. And later, and after I left Yale, the students did a whole big thing where they got the name changed finally. But while I was working there, which, you know, that school has been around 200 more years before me, it's been the John C. Calhoun School. So this is why Ruby's family's last name is Calhoun, is to reference that what if they were his property and they become the founders of this new experiment. But also to say that, like, oh, I felt like I should have been excited or joyous. But all I could think about was, like, I was homeless. I survived a war on drugs. There are people I know who died who are my age. There are people who are not here anymore. There are people who I used to know who I don't know. I had to leave my family at age 11 in order to pursue this life that I'm living. I had to go without family, you know, like, and that it makes me sad talking about it. Because in order to do certain things, there's so much sacrifice that you have, but it's Yale, so you're supposed to be proud of yourself. Your family's supposed to be proud. It's a name everybody knows, and it's only four letters, you know, so it's easy to remember. But for whatever reason, I couldn't shake that my uncle, Horace, who encouraged me to write and read when I was 7 years old, he died of AIDS. You know, he's not here. Where is he in this? You know, my grandmother died before I was born, community activist. When I'm doing this legislative stuff, it's like, wow, I got to do this, but my grandma Mary, she died, you know? So that's what I'm trying to get at, which I try to then flip into motivation, because I know from studying a lot about African spirituality that the ancestors were often more venerated than gods. And so I know that they are ancestors, and that they are present, and that they are working and doing these things, which helps me get through the congressional stuff. For folks who don't know, in 2018, and I talk about this a bit in the book, in the last chapter called Better Have My Money. And ain't no Rihanna fans here, you know? But I talk about receiving a phone call. It was a 202 number, and I initially was like, I'm not answering this. This is IRS, student loan, FBI, whatever. And it was like, answer the phone. And I answered the phone. It's like, hello, can I speak to Professor Marcus Hunter? I'm like, yeah, this is him. Hi, this is Congresswoman Barbara Lee. I'm like, what? Yo. And she invited me to come to DC and work on legislation of hers. And that started off as just like meetings. And then it turned into, I wrote it. Then they introduced it in 2020. Then we were pushing it. Then it was like pushing for elections. Then I was having meetings with the Biden-Harris administration, and we were trying to get things done. And what the Biden-Harris administration was doing then, and has been still doing, is not doing anything on racial equity. Thus far, all we've gotten is Stop Asian Hate, which required thousands of Asian people to be beaten up and bloodied on camera. So this is very similar to Mr. Floyd, where you gotta be on camera being brutalized before people think you deserve legislation. And then Juneteenth, the holiday. For people who don't know, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee sees H.R. 40 and Juneteenth as companion legislation. She was pushing them both at the same time. And so he said, well, we'll do the holiday. But H.R. 40, y'all still gotta work it out. So when we're pushing truth, and H.R. 40, the questions we would get was, well, how does H.R. 40 work with the Truth Commission? Are those groups working together? We hear that there might be dissension in the ranks. And you're like, what? We all getting along. I'm calling and making calls to get co-sponsored. They're at 200 now because of us. They're not even on the floor to be discussed. So the idea is basically we're doing an equity march on June 15th. Everyone here is invited from 12 to 5 p.m. in D.C., on Juneteenth, the one piece of legislation that we were given to apply pressure and to make our voices heard. I take deep, deep, deep exception to any president, let alone one who was elected on 72 plus million voters, who tells the daughter of Mr. Floyd that he will get this done for her. It did not happen. You are not allowed to tell black children lies as the president. You're not allowed to bring them into office, smile in their face, put them up on your shoulder, sit them around and say, I'm so sorry this happened. We're going to make this happen. He's not done it. And the reason why we keep applying pressure is because in 1863, an executive order called the Emancipation Proclamation effectively ended slavery. So you cannot tell me that you can't do something because you know the Congress is dysfunctional. It's not true. So we did an open letter with the members on February 19th with Congresswoman Barbara Lee, Sheila Jackson Lee, Cori Bush, and Jamal Bowman. And then we had 150-plus organizations, including the National Action Network and Until Freedom. Shout out to Tamika Mallory. Send open letters with a suite of racial equity legislation. So it's not just H.R. 40. There's the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which, by the way, wasn't originally called the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. They called it that once he ascended, thinking that maybe because everybody loves John Lewis in Congress, y'all will stop being dysfunctional about this. They even made it H.R. 1, which meant it's the first priority for Congress. Didn't happen. And so how do we get into a reality where we hold elected officials accountable? And I think one way to do it is that no matter who the president is, we still gonna be making these requests. And one thing that I plan to say to President Biden is, you're a fool if you don't think that Donald Trump won't just come out and say, I support reparations. Like, I don't think that they understand that he's a man who will say anything for clout. Like, he will. He said, I am the best president since Abraham Lincoln for black people. How dare you say that I'm racist? Ask Ray J. Ask Kodak Black. Ask about me in these streets. Best black president since Abraham Lincoln. Why wouldn't he say, if elected, I'll give you reparations? They won't. They're too afraid to even say it, which is true. And so I also just think about the political reality we're in, where you don't have to mean what you say. And if somebody else options that, then it's way out of control, because I know he's not gonna do it, for real, for real. And between me, you, and the red light that's in my eye, when President Biden was elected, he had a closed door meeting with the major leaders of the top six civil rights organizations where he says, I am supportive of reparations. Has it felt like that? Has it sounded like that? Has it looked like that? This is what I'm trying to say. You don't continue to get to do this to black people, to tell us something, or as they say now in the culture, to play in my face. You telling me something so I can keep being on your side, when in fact you're gonna keep saying it has to pass through Congress. I mean, I'm not a legislator. It's like, you always knew that it wasn't gonna happen that way. So that doesn't mean that you get to abscond your duties and not do your job. There are things that you owe people. And like the Juneteenth holiday demonstrates, legislation that acknowledges, recognizes, and celebrates black people benefits everybody. Last I checked, everybody's off on Juneteenth. Why are we not thinking that reparations would have a similar effect?
So do we have some questions?
As a Yale professor, listen, that's a good thing. Hallelujah. Glory be to God. So as a Yale professor, I was actually just curious when it came to actually writing some of these parables, if you did some research or were inspired, if you will, from Marcus Garvey.
Oh, of course.
And actually what happened in Liberia.
Yeah, of course. There's a open resource that is free called Say It Loud. It is speeches by legendary black people. And so for a good while, I mean, I just listened to those on repeat over and over again, and also just taking the wisdom of their experience. You know, this is why I say America has a funny way of being America, you know. And so when we start talking about things and thinking we're getting places, we always have to have an eye out, an ear out for how America works, though, at the same time. So in his example, of course, it becomes tax evasion, tax fraud, now you're in jail, and then now everybody makes you out to be like a crazy person. But I also take a lot of inspiration from his wife, Amy Jakes Garvey, as well, because when he was sent away, she kept it going, like Winnie Mandela. And so the idea is really to pull from all of those experiences. You know, Ruby, who's the central character in the Jubilee story, is part Malcolm X, part Coretta Scott King, part Ella Baker. You know, she's like part Pauli Murray, part like a lot of different people who I don't think have gotten their due, and trying to wrap them all up in a very beautiful blue dress that she wears on 60 Minutes in the story, and having her reflect a lot of those things, because I've been deeply influenced by, I mean, in my household, and I tell people this, before Issa Rae says she's rooting for everybody black, that was 1237 Christian Street. I mean, like, you know, everything black. I know of the Williams sisters because they were black. You know, like, my parents were like, they're black girls playing tennis, we watching that. You know, as soon as they were done, we not watching that. You know, like, it's like, so, it's like, Debbie Thomas is ice skating, we love ice skating. Go Debbie! You know, like, oh, Dominique Dawes is doing backflips. We love gymnastics. You know, like, that's the household I grew up in. So for me, what I was trying to do was reflect every single Black person that I know has contributed to the positive experience of Blackness. So even down to the smile principle, there's a glorious song called On Your Face that I listen to probably every single day by the greatest band of all time, Earth, Wind, and Fire. Mm-hmm. And the whole song is about how your smile can change your life. That when you wear a frown, you're gonna go down. If you put a smile on your face, you'll keep a pace that keeps you going forward. Keep your head to the sky. I mean, there's so much in Earth, Wind, and Fire that is about spiritual principles that are actually then biologically true. Your smile is the anchor to your thymus gland system, which promotes and ensures a healthy immune system. So when we think about COVID killing Black people go, it's because they love Popeye's chicken. It's because they eat so much of this, or because soul food is actually unhealthy, or slavery is a pre-existing condition. They put a bit in your mouth and you lived in it for months. When they wanted to punish you for talking too much, they put it back in your mouth. You are not able to heal yourself. So fast forward, a lot of this is what I say a lot about reparations, is that it's always looking at the people who were torn apart by it and not about the thing that tore them apart. Why are we always looking at them for evidence of success? And also to change the conversation, this is back to your Marcus Garvey question. Marcus Garvey is a great reminder that when poor, working class, middle class, Black, Latino, Indian, Native American people are making claims about demands that they want, and then people say, well, Marcus Garvey, you're a Jamaican immigrant and you created your own enterprise. You're very successful. Why do you need anything? That's a conversation between me and God. The US government is not God. Why do you get to be talking about what I'm doing for myself and excusing yourself from what you constitutionalized, authorized, permitted, legalized? That's what we're talking about. The fact that we have a Serena Williams and a Venus and a Beyonce and a Rihanna and a Usher and a Michael Jackson, a Janet Jackson. I could keep going. Luther Vandross, Whitney Houston, Erykah Badu, Bob Marley, Fela Kuti, Miriam Makeba. I could just go down. Hugh Masekela. Is a testament to the glory of God and our ability to have fortitude to still be human despite what's around us, not about what the US government or any government has done for us. We're still waiting on that. Whitney Houston is in spite of the US government, not because of it. You know, when we're seeing somebody be successful in Black, too many times we excuse the system and we think, oh, it's because assimilation and affirmative action must have worked. No, they are that in spite of all of those things. That is about a conversation between God and that person and how they're able to keep going forward through prayer and meditation. That is not about some program that the U.S. government has done. And that Marcus Garvey was very right about.
How you doing? When it comes to reparations, usually reparations do tie in with either nationality or ethnicity. And understanding that the word Black and white is a social construct.
Right.
Is that understanding in the book that that's part of the reason why they won't give us reparations as well, because there's nothing to tie into repair when it comes to nationality? It, like people always ask, why do Jews get reparations? Why do the Japanese? Mm-hmm. Why do Asians? Why do this get reparations? Because they have a home to go back to. They have a tie-in with the nationality or with the ethnicity that's legit. There is no land or island of Black.
Yeah, so great question. Right now, that's actually a hot button issue in the pro-reparation space, where eligibility has been a big thing. And California, the First in the Nation Commission, passed the eligibility standard, a 5-4 decision, which said that it had to be someone who can demonstrate that they are descended from an African-American person who was enslaved. For me, I just sort of think about wanting the party to exist before we start crafting the invitation. So I live out in LA. What I've learned in LA, that there's levels to the party. So of course there's the venue, then there's the invitation, but you gotta get the confirmation of the invitation. Then when you gotta get there, then it might be general admission. Then there's VIP, then there's VIP VIP, and then there's talent. Then there's management. And so what I keep thinking is sometimes the eligibility conversation to me is cutting your nose off to spite your face, because you want as many people to feel like it's coming for them to me. as possible. And you visit with it on the other side about who's got the bracelet that's purple, whose bracelet is brown, you're over here, you're over there, that there can be levels to the resource. And so I do have some concern about that. I will also say, on the point about land or place of home, once upon a time, not long ago, when slavery ended, the American Colonization Society told Black people, you know, they pulled up boats the way we would pull up cars. So ski, pull up. They pulled up boats and they said, y'all can go back to Africa. We got a place for y'all. And you know what Black people said? In the words of the sociologist, Miss Sophia, hell no. They didn't go. So to me, this is home. This is home. What that looks like in terms of land ownership is a different conversation. But home space, this is. It is. People chose it. I mean, my first book was about Philadelphia. This place would not exist, this library, this city, if Black people didn't stay here. White people abandoned this place a long time ago. They're back now. And they ought to thank all of the Black people who've been here because they left the city to die. You know, it was not supposed to make it. And so part of that is to say you're right on one level about land and that kind of thing. But on another spiritual level, you know, home is where you reside. Home is where your mama is. Home is where your grandmama's from. Home is where your great granddaddy cut his first finger. You know, that's where your home is. And African Americans or Black Americans have a very deep sense of that. And I think a lot of times having to go and look and find a place is beside the point because you're not going to be able to do that because no space was ever really made for you. You were always made to make space for other people, build space for other people. So I think that's a great conversation. And I like that conversation because it's in the context of reparations happening. That's the kind of conversations I want to have, a debate I want to have. I don't want us to agree. I want us to just be in a pro-reparations, it's happening, how do we want it to look kind of space.
Thank you all for coming out. Marcus is going to go up and sign books and great book. Thank you for
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.